This is The Guardian.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, Pod fans. Max here. Just to say that Jonathan Liu forgot to press record, so he will be in Zoom quality until an excellent answer about Chelsea's transfer window plans, which you'll hear about 15 minutes into part three. So look out for that. Until then, the rest of us all sound marvellous, and what Johnny says is fascinating and brilliant. Enjoy the pod. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Is it Kloppage time, Jurgi time, Kloppy seconds, or just a ref finally playing the right amount of added time after a team wastes their own time? Either way, a pretty sickening way for Newcastle to lose and a lovely moment for Fabio Carvalho. Manchester City have a good new striker, a brace for Julian Alvarez in a 6-0 walloping of Nottingham Forest. Arsenal still at 100%. I imagine those losers celebrated again after beating out of sorts Aston Villa. A return to forget for Emi Martinez, a pod to remember for Jordan Jarrett Bryan. Spurs just about hold on to a point at West Ham, and the Gary O'Neill bounce gets Bournemouth a goalless draw at home to won't ever score again Wolverhampton Wanderers. We're live in the Jazz Bar as Ewan Murray looks forward to the Old Firm and both sides' chances in the Champions League, and it's transfer deadline day. Can I face repeating my Graham Doran's anecdote? All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Johnny Liu, hello.
Hi.
Hello, Jordan Jarrett Bryan.
Morning, pal.
And hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max Rushton.
Okay, let's start at Anfield then. Liverpool 2, Newcastle 1. Fabio Carvalho's last-minute winner with the clock on 97 minutes and 10 seconds or thereabouts. And the ref had said a minimum of 5 minutes added time. What a moment for the lad. It sparked like a mass confrontation between the dugouts. Not quite as exciting as last-minute winners in Liverpool-Newcastle games from the 90s. But still, Barry, an entertaining end to that football match.
Yeah, and I suppose the key word you use there is minimum added time of 5 minutes was recommended. But it went into, we had an extra three in which Liverpool scored, and Newcastle fans are outraged by this. But the fact of the matter is they were time-wasting for England at Anfield last night, faking injuries, tactical fouls, kicking the ball away. Nick Pope put on a masterclass of time wasting, something he was excellent at Burnley, one of his major attributes. And if you want to do that, fine, go for it. But don't complain if the ref takes it into account when deciding when to blow the final whistle. And seeing the outrage of Newcastle fans, I'm reminded of the many hundreds and possibly thousands of them who, over the course of the last 9 months, have sent me that Kylian Mbappe cry more gif on Twitter. And, well, you know, consider it sent back your way.
Do you think Liverpool deserved it, Johnny?
It's an interesting one. Deserved is, I mean, they had what, 23 shots. They had, you know, some pretty decent sights of goal. And yet, they did kind of look pretty incontinent for a lot of it. The same slow, turgid, kind of conservative build-up that kind of epitomizes Liverpool when they're not clicking, when things aren't really going well for them. Clearly, the winning goal itself, it feels like it could be a transformative moment. It feels like one of those things that can galvanize the season. And Klopp said, you know, they'll remember this for many years. But I still see kind of too many issues in there, particularly in midfield and with the injuries that they've had, for them to take too much optimism from it. They still don't look like a team to me that is going to challenge for the title. And despite beating Bournemouth 9-0, they can take momentum from it, but I don't think they can take a huge amount of footballing confidence.
Jordan?
Yeah, no, I tend to agree. I think I'm interested to see if Nunez comes back into that team, because I reckon Klopp would have been raging at that red card and having, you know, one of his main signing out for these three games. I wonder if he brings him back into this team, having, you know, the side now won two games, 1-9-0 and one in dramatic fashion in the 98th minute. I agree with Johnny. I don't see them being title contenders long term. I just think there's too much with that team. It was floated pre-season that playing every single game last year at the intensity they play may take its toll on this team. And I fear that may be the case. I think they'll be in the top four, no problem. But I think really pushing the City team is going to be a big ask. And they're kind of just hanging on. They're at that 5-point gap whereby they're not out of the title race, but 6, 7, 8 points, even at this stage, I think they will struggle to reel them in this time. So I don't think it's a Liverpool team that looks like they're all on the same page and looking like they're going to be the title contenders. But I think they just about shaded the game and served the 3 points, yes.
What did you make of Mr. Isak, Alexander Isak, Barry?
Oh, hugely impressed. He got straight into the team after securing a work permit yesterday afternoon. I think that issue of work permits is possibly something we need to think or talk about at some point. Another benefit of the sunny uplands of Brexit. But he scored one excellent goal, set up by a lovely weighted pass from Sean Longstaff, who I think has been the subject of, I don't know if it's ridicule, but Newcastle fans don't seem that keen on him. And he's a player you wouldn't have expected to be lining up for Newcastle this season, but needs must, because Guimaraes is injured. And so is John Joe Shelby. And then he was very unlucky for the second goal that was disallowed for offside. There was a hair's breadth in it, and that has also outraged Newcastle fans, some of whom do genuinely think there's a conspiracy to stop them breaking into the top six. They will at some point break into the top six, and if I was a Newcastle fan, I would be annoyed that goal was disallowed. And of course, tribalism dictates I would be annoyed by the amount of stoppage time played, but they can take heart from that performance and their performance against Manchester City, because Eddie Howe hasn't done well. He has done very well since taking over, but he hasn't done well against teams in the big six. I think he's only beaten one in 9 or 10 attempts, but he's drawn against two already this season. So both away from home, if I'm not mistaken.
I think on the Isak thing, Max, as well, I wonder if we're back now to the mid-90s era where there was the plethora of top strikers spread across the league. I was thinking about it last night. It's not just your Haalands and your Nunezes and your Ronaldos and your Canes, your Son, Jesus, but you've also got Callum Wilson is a fabulous striker, just can't stay fit. I'm a really big fan of Ivan Toney. Isak looks like he could be a guy that could really rip up this league and score 15 goals minimum. There's a nice spread of really good strikers that go from very good to Mitrovic. Yeah, there's some. I think we've got a nice spread of strikers across the league again that reminds me of the kind of Fowler, Cole, Ferdinand, Sheringham era of the mid-90s.
Do you think, Johnny, that like the target man type player is back? I mean, we will get on to Haaland, of course, who's completely ridiculous, but just the idea that, you know, football goes in cycles and tactically it changes, and I wonder if there is now a space. There seems to be a space for the big lad.
Yeah, my theory is that as the gap between the best teams and the not so best teams grows, you are going to see increasingly a lot of games where good teams are playing against deep set defenses who aren't going to be drawn out, and For a few years, what Guardiola and Klopp in particular tried to do was, you know, you would try and work the defence around. You would try and lure them out with movement, and you wouldn't necessarily have that target man because you were trying to draw them out and work them around. And I think teams have maybe got a little bit smarter, or they've adapted over time. And they said if you just hold your position, if you kind of protect those central areas, it's harder for those sorts of sides to hurt you. And there just comes a point where you need somebody to just win a one-on-one header in the box, or you need someone to feast on a loose ball. And I think that's one of the main trends that we're seeing at the very top teams, that you need someone who can do that. Not necessarily as your number one option, but you certainly need someone who can do that in tight games against teams who are putting 11 men behind the ball.
I mean, it seems like a sensible time to move on to Manchester City 6, Nottingham Forest 0. I mean, it's already a challenge to say something new about Erling Braut Haaland, and we're only 4 weeks into the season. I mean, Lord knows what we'll do in April. 9 goals in 5 games after that second hat-trick in 2 games. A new Premier League record surpassing Mickey Quinn. It's nice to hear Mickey Quinn just being chatted, talked about, isn't it, for a while. And Sergio Aguero. Yes, Baz?
Well, we know Mickey from his TalkSport days. We know him quite well. And he will be devastated that his record is gone. He was so proud of that record. So proud. And I would say he is heartbroken this morning. But it must be nice for him, all the same, to see his name up in lights just under Erling Haaland.
And if you're going to lose it, you might as well lose it to Erling Haaland. I mean, so many questions on him. Chris says, how many more weeks do we need to see of Haaland to assess his readiness to play in the Premier League? Batch says, based on his goal-scoring ratio to date, by the end of the season, Erling Haaland is set to score 68 goals. Will this be a disappointment? Interesting question from Lion Hand Solo. A few others have made this point, Jordan. You know, far from enhancing the Premier League, has he destroyed it? Second hat-trick already and the title race is over.
Well, first of all, I think he'll make another record this weekend when he smashes Aston Villa and gets a hat-trick there, making it 3 hat-tricks in a row. So I'll take a lot of fun with that. But I think that the project really for most defenders and managers this season will be, how do we stop Haaland and City? Because I think that's going to be, he's that good. He's almost a project within himself, and working out how to stop him from getting the ball, getting the aerial, you know, having an aerial threat, getting the ball to ground, getting the ball in behind. I believe that will be the job of managers now. Not only how do you stop City from winning this game, but how do you stop Haaland from having an out-and-out game in itself? I don't think he's killing the league. I think for everybody else to up their levels and work out how to prevent this freak of nature, if you like, from causing continuous havoc.
But presumably, if you manage to stop him, it will take some players, Johnny, and that may open the door to other players that Manchester City also have.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at that first goal against Forest pretty much do everything that a team should do to try and stop City scoring against you. Traditionally, they've sat deep, they forced City wide, they forced it to work it round, and then an innocuous cross comes into the area. And most times against most teams, you would back your centre halves to deal with that. You know, one-on-one header coming into your box, you just clear your lines. And what Haaland does to Joe Worrall is just...
And Joe Worrall is a big lad, right? You know, he is a big guy.
He's seen some things, man. And Haaland just levers him out of the way, almost like he uses him as an armchair. And suddenly Worrall is in this kind of this world of weights and pulleys that he's been sucked into the sunken place, and he can't do anything. That's what he can do. That's why City is so dangerous, because teams that have defended a certain way against them can no longer defend that way, because you can't leave Haaland one-on-one against anyone.
I was thinking about this last night after his first goal, where he monstered Joe Worrall, and you know, it was a constant cliche about Teddy Sheringham that he had an extra yard in his head to make up for his lack of pace. But Haaland has more pace than most and seems to have an extra 2 yards in his head as well, which just makes him almost impossible to defend against.
John?
So I was going to say that the scary thing is he gets a month off in December as well, because he's not going to the World Cup.
It's a very good point. We had some other Haaland-based questions. Rob says, best on his Octo-Champ record, for those out of the UK, Johnny Liu won the quiz show countdown, the words and numbers-based countdown, 8 times in a row, which is the most you can do it before you have to just retire. How many consecutive hat-tricks does Johnny believe Haaland should be allowed to score before being stopped from competing?
Yeah, I wonder if he keeps on claiming match balls, whether the Premier League will eventually have a shortage of footballs. Well, hang on, we're about to kick off. Where's the ball? Well, I'm afraid they're all in Erling's house. Could someone liberate them, please?
Yeah, you just open the front door of his house again, an avalanche of footballs. Bounce down the driveway.
Steve Cooper was extremely upset at Richarlison taking the piss for Spurs on Sunday. I mean, bringing on Kevin De Bruyne at 5-0. I wouldn't want any of my staff doing that. It's disrespectful to the game.
I did like this from TDJ going, curious to know if Steve Cooper will get sacked when he inevitably complains about the lack of backing from the board following this drubbing from City. But look, we gave City the title this time last season, a few weeks into the season. We just said it was theirs. They were so far ahead. They went on a bad run. Liverpool almost chased them down. We don't need to be hasty, or Jordan, do you think we can be hasty? Like if Liverpool aren't going to compete, we're going to touch on Arsenal and Spurs in a minute. Who really is there who's got the depth and the staying power to stick with them?
Well, I was racking my brain pre-season, Matt, to try and think of a reason why City wouldn't win the league. And I couldn't come up with many reasons. I mean, if they get half their squad injured, some Leicester City-type season happens again, I can't think of many reasons. This is before a ball was kicked, as to why they won't win the title this year. And five games in, I've got even less reasons to kind of, offer as to why they won't win the title. You're looking for some kind of mad implosion. Liverpool, as you mentioned, their biggest rivals of the last couple of years. They're not going to challenge them all the way, I don't think. Arsenal, we'll get to my mob in a bit. Over the course of the season, I'm not so sure. So, no, I think they will win the league. I think they'll win it quite comfortably now as well.
The World Cup is the X factor there. I mean, they lose pretty much their whole team except Haaland.
True.
Liverpool, I think, get off a little bit easier. If they're still in touch, maybe that's a factor.
Possibly. Although City could just play Haaland for a few games and probably be all right, couldn't they?
Could we have a quick word, actually, for Julian Alvarez, who I sort of predicted might be one of the signings of the season. He was outstanding last night, but his performance has obviously been completely overshadowed by that of the big man. I'm sure he doesn't mind, but tip of the hat to him, he was brilliant.
Yeah, it's good for City to have some strength and depth, isn't it? Helps the league along. Right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with the leaders, Arsenal, against out-of-sorts Aston Villa.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Arsenal 2, Villa 1. Then Joe says, when does Jordan think Arsenal will win the league by 5 wins out of 5? They probably celebrated too much again, Jordan. From the highlights of this game, Jordan, it just looked like a goal-mouth scramble in Villa's penalty area, like for 90 minutes.
We battered them. Arsenal pretty much battered Aston Villa for most of the game. One of the biggest concerns for me in terms of the top four pursuit is Arsenal not killing off games. Their ratio of dominance to goals scored isn't good. We dominate against Leicester, should have scored more. Dominate against Fulham, should have scored more. And same in this game as well. And I think that's something that we've been getting away with to some degree, but may not over the course of the season. So we were the better team by a mile. I hope you give me some time at the end to talk about Aston Villa, because I've got a few things I want to say about them. But on Arsenal themselves, 5 out of 5, that's a brilliant start. People talk about, oh, the usual kind of caveat of it's only early, it's only five games in, they've only played so-and-so teams, but it's 5 out of 5, and most teams don't win their first five games of the season. I think Arteta deserves a bit of credit for what he's done with Xhaka. I believe Aleppo never changed its spots, and I think there will be a red card or a penalty conceded at some point from Xhaka. But what he's done in this new box-to-box role is ensure that when he does cock up, it's in their half or it's in their penalty box rather than ours. I think that's something that I think he deserves a little bit of credit for as well. And Saka wants to mention too as well, because the fan base are mentioning Saka saying he's not been playing really well. He's not, you know, he's not the same. He's not as good as last year. And I disagree, because what I think is happening is that he's playing well. It's the difference now is that he's not the only one playing well. There's no responsibility on him to win every game for Arsenal. Jesus is doing his thing. Xhaka's playing better. Zinchenko's had an impact as well. So I think whereas what's happening with Saka is what should have been happening with the likes of Jack Wilshere, which is playing in a team where you're not expected to play 8 or 9 out of 10 every single game. He can develop, play well, go under the radar, and still perform well, whilst others, more senior players, are the ones carrying the burden of winning games. So I think the fan base need to be a little bit more patient with Saka, and I think he'll have an impact in the second half of the season. But yeah, great start from Arsenal. Old Trafford on the weekend, I think a win is a great result. Obviously, a point, I'll take that right now and just keep the momentum going on. But I'm happy days right now, happy days.
Yeah, they were so dominant, Johnny. But you sort of felt if Emi Martinez had been as good as he kind of has been, they might actually not have won this game.
Yeah, I give him not a pass, but I have a little bit of sympathy with him for the first goal, because that cross takes takes a wicked deflection off, and you know, you're in the lap of the gods there. Where does that loose ball go? I mean, do we talk about Villa? I mean,
oh yes.
This is not an original point, but lots of people have pointed out that Gerrard as a manager in what is this, his fifth season as senior manager, doesn't appear to have a distinct footballing identity. And that's not a problem as such. You know, lots of great managers have made a virtue out of pragmatism. The trouble is that you are kind of inextricably tied to results in a way that, for example, Graham Potter isn't, or Steve Cooper isn't, because you know they have a method. And when things are going badly, you know, this is what we're trying to do. This is what we go back to. These are the principles that are going to see us through. Now with Gerrard, it's a little bit like Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now. I don't see any method at all, sir. But Leon Bailey is out of the team and he's back in the team. Coutinho is in the team, but he's out of the team. Tyrone Mings is out and then he's back in. So there's no consistency of selection. There's no real consistency of tactics or any kind of discernible style. And again, you know, I reiterate, that is fine. But when results aren't going well, players are going to look around and go, so what are we? How do we get out of this? And whether Gerrard, you know, the big test for Gerrard now is whether he is experienced enough and I guess intuitive enough as a manager to not only work out what needs to be done, but communicate what needs to be done in a way that is going to unite a dressing room that looks actually fairly disparate at the moment.
Barry, I actually thought that the changes he made looked like sensible ones, even if he didn't get a result. I thought, you know, Ings and Watkins wasn't working, and I think Coutinho hadn't been playing well. But as Johnny says, you've got to eventually get something out of a game, haven't you?
Well, he appears to have no idea whatsoever what his best starting 11 is, if everyone's fit. The impression I get is the fans don't like him. They consider him aloof. I don't think they appreciated his treatment of Tyrone Mings at the start of the season. Now, I don't know what happened there, but there seems to have been some sort of falling out. And there's a notion that his former assistant, Michael Beale, who's now managing QPR, was the brains of that particular operation, and that Gerrard's a bit lost without him. He's made some high-profile signings that haven't failed, but they haven't particularly worked out either. And will he be given time? I think Christian Purslow, the Aston Villa chief exec who's previously worked at Liverpool, is heavily invested in him, so that might work in his favour. But, you know, Man City next up, so should be fine.
John?
Yeah, I mean, if I was an Aston Villa fan, and you know, thank God I'm not, I'd be concerned, and I know you have to caveat everything, like I said, with it's early, but to the point that Barry just makes there about the you know, Perslow and Gerrard, I'd be concerned if I was a Villa fan, because I think that they're in trouble, because I think they will stick with Gerrard longer than they probably should. I think he'll give him more time than he probably should get, and I think that ultimately of the season will leave them in a trickier situation come the second half of the season. I think they've got a really good team there, and I think they're massively underperforming. My concern about Gerrard and the fanfare of having a name like him at Villa, and the no doubt passionate team talks that he was offering when he first got there, was all well and good. But again, as Barry alluded to, the kind of tactical acumen of how good he actually is, it was something I was always a bit concerned about and kind of questioned. So Villa fans, for me, should be concerned, because they've got a very, very good team there. Their captain, John McGinn, is someone that I think is massively overrated. I know everyone loves him. I think he's a good Premier League player. I don't think he's as good as everyone makes him out to be. Do you know what I mean? But they do have some really good players there. And I think that he doesn't really have an excuse. He's been backed. He has been backed. And I think that by sticking with him longer than they should, I think will ultimately keep them in that bottom five for most of the season.
Kevin says, after Barry said Douglas Luiz should not waste those kind of goals from corner kicks for lesser games, was tonight's game sufficiently important enough for it to be used?
It was, but it's a waste again, because they lost. And he'll surely not get away with it the third time. But
Ian says, I really enjoyed the West Ham Spurs game. Hammers starting to hit our straps. Excellent work from VAR tonight. The 3-minute silent interlude generated more atmosphere than the pre-match light show and deafening DJ. West Ham looked pretty good in this second half. And Johnny, they probably, if either side was going to win it, they should have won it.
Yeah, I mean, you said in your intro that Spurs kind of clung on. And I think they sort of did. West Ham sort of blew out about kind of 80, 85 minutes. And actually, for the end of it, I thought Tottenham actually looked the likelier to score. That said, you know, probably a fair result. You know, for all the new signings that West Ham have made, that was pretty much, I think, apart from Kehrer, I think that was basically their side from last year out on the pitch last night. And, you know, it kind of showed. They looked a bit more, they looked a little bit more cohesive. I don't know whether it's coming together as such. I still think Moyes is sort of on borrowed time, and there is a little bit of a hangover from last season and the way last season ended. But yeah, Spurs are one of those teams that tend to bring the best out of West Ham, whatever kind of state they're in. And they certainly looked a lot better last night.
The touch from Antonio is so good for Suchek's goal, even if Spurs kind of stopped playing. It looked like a foul throw to me. I mean, maybe I'm just completely biased, but it did look like a foul throw. I mean, listen, they're never, ever given, so I'm not complaining about it.
I think you were a little bit. I can't say so I noticed, bit. But
I am complaining about it slightly. But like, West Ham fully deserve the point there. Spurs are weird, aren't they, Jordan? Because when they break, like the goal they scored last night, and they break with pace, they are pretty scintillating for like 10 seconds. But for most of the game, and bear in mind I got up quite early to watch this game, it is just watching Eric Dier pass to Davinson Sanchez and him pass it back again. It's sort of like England in the 90s, you know, like what, or the 2000s. Like, what's happening? Like, is there a plan B? You sort of think if you sit deep, they're just not quite good enough to break you down. They don't have anyone who can really pass the ball that well. Kulusevski is obviously brilliant, but like they don't have, maybe Bentancur, who wasn't there, can do it. But they just feel a bit stodgy.
Yeah, they do feel stodgy. And I think that they can only get away with but we're getting wins and we're getting points for so long. I don't subscribe to the cliche that sign of a good team is one that doesn't play well and wins games. I don't buy into that. I think one or two games you can get away with it, but you don't win anything by not playing well. You have to play well at some point. And I don't think that they are consistently playing well. And I think they will need to find that person. We'll see today if they sign anybody in the transfer window. It's unlikely. That can be that unlocker of doors that can break down teams, because you can only rely on Son and Kane to do something magical for so long before that does become a problem. I'm really interested by Perisic. He's the most Antonio Conte player I think I've ever seen. Like, his influence the last two or three games is really growing, and he's just very, very robotic, and he gets to the byline somehow, chips it in, and it's normally, you know, a header on goal. And I think that sort of player at wing-back where he plays is so, so Conte. And I just can't think of a player off the top of my head right now that is so in the embodiment of their manager and the role that he knows he has to play, and he does it so well. But yeah, they need to up their levels a little bit if they're gonna push my lot.
I enjoyed David Moyes saying he admires Antonio Conte, quote, because it's not about style. He's only interested in winning. So that's a nice backhanded compliment there. Antonio Conte was furious, Johnny, with the VAR for not giving that penalty when the VAR, I think, was completely correct to not give that penalty, even if it did take quite a long time. Have you got any further thoughts on sort of Tottenham?
Well, just that I think it's impossible. Anyone who says they know how it's going to go from here is probably, you know, making a bit of a leap, because we know what Conte can do with a side. We know how Conte teams build into a season. He's done it pretty much everywhere he's been, Chelsea, Inter Milan. That his teams don't often start well, but as they gel, as the kind of the automatisms start to work and they get drilled, they grow into the season and then, you know, they can go on a run. That can easily happen. But, you know, like Jordan said, you'd probably, if you're a Spurs fan, you'd probably rather they were playing well. You'd probably rather Yves Bissouma, who came in last night, didn't spend 90 minutes just passing the ball back to the guy who had just passed it to him. Effectively all he did. I didn't watch all 90 minutes, but I didn't really see him do anything else. And Son obviously is a big concern for them. And I think Richarlison should be coming in for him, but I don't think he will. So yeah, I mean, there were problems there.
Antonio Conte, I think he's well within his rights to be furious about the handball decision, but I don't think he's well within his rights to go in front of TV cameras and accuse the referee and the VAR official of at best incompetence and at worst corruption when they have made the correct decision. He'll get a fine that won't really matter. But the thing is, supporters take their lead from that and then they vent their fury at the injustice of it all, or the perceived injustice. And that's why certain areas of the game around officialdom are as toxic as they are now. So I think managers need to do better on that front.
Mm. And I just don't quite understand. I know that, you know, it all covers over perhaps them not playing well. They're not going to, like, is it Peter Banks? He's not going to go, "I've just heard Antonio Conte's not happy, I'll go back and give the penalty like an hour later." It's just not going to change the results. Always so refreshing. So I thought Eddie Howe after last night was quite refreshing. Not complaining, just went, "Oh, it's just a sickening way to lose a football match. It's really it's really annoying, but you have to take it." It was quite refreshing to hear a manager sort of be quite reasonable. Bournemouth 0, Wolves 0. Alex said, "Are Wolves at risk of going down? A lot of talk saying they'll be fine, but they haven't won since April. They look woefully short of ideas going forward." Barry?
On the face of it, you would say the football they play is excellent and they look too good to go down. But I think we said that about Fulham under Scott Parker and they went down like a stone. Wolves just can't score goals. And again, last night, this was a game of familiar failings. They just seemed incapable of getting the ball on target. I've looked them down, missing five decent chances. Raul Jimenez responsible for two of them. Mateus Nunes, their new record signing, he hit the bar, so I suppose maybe he was a little unlucky. And Daniel Podence had a header he probably should have scored, cleared off the line. So the Wolves fans are not happy, and they've booed their team off in the last two games, so make of that what you will.
Tonight, Leicester, Manchester United. We'll touch on that on Monday. In the Premier League, Merseyside derby, early kickoff on Saturday is probably the biggest game of the weekend. Manchester United, Arsenal on Sunday as well. And that'll do for part two. You and Murray will join us in part three for a proper Fitbar corner.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's do a proper Fitbar corner with Ewan Murray. Joins us. Hey, mate.
Good to be back. How are you all?
Yeah, really good. Just wanted to spend some time talking about Celtic and Rangers, both in the Champions League. Old Firm on Saturday with a couple of points between them at the top of the league. Is Is Scottish football good, Ewan?
Steady. I think this is a very interesting game because I think they're, although I think Celtic have the edge, I think the two of them are pretty evenly matched. The fact, as you said, they're both in the Champions League adds an extra dimension to the season. The broader question about the state of Scottish football, I'm still pretty sceptical about that, but I think it's quite right to look forward to this game on Saturday with you know, a bit of expectation. It's an important game. I think everything points towards these games being hugely significant, if they're not normally, certainly this season in the context of the title, and I'm looking forward to it. I think it should be a good game.
Rangers was really impressive in Eindhoven. I think, you know, that's, I watched that game and I really thought they played very well. And again, not many people gave them a lot of hope in. Can they push Celtic? And how impressed with Van Bronckhorst have you been?
Well, they can push Celtic, yeah. Van Bronckhorst is strange. I remain, the jury's still out as far as I'm concerned. You cannot ignore that they did fantastically well in getting to the Europa League final last season. But this was a team that was, I think I'm right in saying, 6 points clear at the turn of the year in the Premiership in Scotland. And didn't win the league. Celtic turned that round. Now, you could say that one played a part in the other. Perhaps European exertions hurt them in the league. But you know, to give up that advantage when they were the defending champions, they were in a position of strength. Celtic under Postecoglou, although he hit the ground running, they were in a period of transition. I still think that's a black mark against Rangers and Van Bronckhorst that probably wasn't given much attention because of what they did in Europe, and they were rightly praised for what they did in Europe. So I think this is a very important season for Rangers domestically to see if they can, you know, what they have to show is that the season when they did win the league and stopped Celtic's 10 in a row wasn't just the exception, wasn't just the blip season out of the last however many. And I think we still have to see if that's going to be the case.
Postecoglou is pretty impressive man. I interviewed him on Monday for Australian TV. I mean, they're absolutely obsessed. Australian soccer fans are obsessed with Ange Postecoglou. And like at the start, I was like, come on, it's just a bloke. But actually, like, he's so articulate and he gets it so much that I'm starting to get obsessed with him as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've made this point before, but what I really like about him is he doesn't get involved in any of the nonsense in Glasgow. He doesn't kiss badges. He doesn't annihilate referees. He doesn't play games in the media. And it's very easy to get... Now, to be fair, Van Bronckhorst is exactly the same. But to be fair, it's very easy to get drawn into that trap, especially as you know, Van Bronckhorst at least had played at Rangers and would understand the kind of lie of the land. Postecoglou has come in fresh and has just stayed true to himself, and he hasn't engaged in some of the nonsense or you know, hype or drama or daft games that go on in Glasgow. And I admire him for that. He's just got on with his job. He's done it very well. And you know, I'm sure we'll touch on it, but I'm going to be fascinated to see how he does in the Champions League this season, obviously a completely different level, and he'll be keen to stamp his mark on that kind of platform as well.
Well, let's ask you about that. Mick says, Celtic will make Carlo's other eyebrow lift with the shock of how amazing Ange Ball is. Football emoji, shamrock emoji, shamrock emoji, 3-1 Celtic, etc, etc, etc. Quite objective view, but it is, I mean, home to Real Madrid is such a brilliant tie for them in the first game, and it will be fascinating. So Real Madrid don't start Champions League campaigns that quickly. It doesn't tend to matter. They'll win it in the end, but like Celtic could do something.
Yeah, and this will be a keenly anticipated game because for all the, you know, in previous seasons in Scotland, Celtic and Rangers have played obviously a lot in the Champions League, but never against Real Madrid. Barcelona have been routine visitors to Glasgow, Manchester United, Milan. We've seen almost all of them, but not Real Madrid. I think it's 50 years perhaps since Celtic played Real Madrid, and Celtic beat them, I'm pretty sure, the last time. 42 years. So it's a kind of widely anticipated fixture for those reasons as well. I touched on it. I'm intrigued to see how this Celtic team, which, you know, can dismantle sides in Scotland with not quite ease, but they can do it regularly. I'm intrigued to see what happens when they step up a level. If they adapt the way they play, if they can be more pragmatic or defensive, or if they just, you know, Ange Postecoglou, the way he works is that, you know, they work and work and work on plan A, and if plan A doesn't work, they do it better. So I remember Brendan Rodgers got quite a lot of criticism when he was at Celtic because he adopted pretty much the same philosophy in Europe, and Celtic were tanked by a lot of the better teams. So Postecoglou's approach will be very, very interesting starting next week.
Players-wise for Celtic, who do you think can step up? Who are you most interested to see making that leap?
Kyogo Furuhashi, the Japanese forward, who I think is fantastic. And I get criticised for saying this because I'm accused of selling the best players, but I remain slightly surprised that a team, even already from England in the Premier League, hasn't come in and tried to buy him. His touch is sublime, his movement is sublime, he can score goals. But again, this is part of it. This is a different level for him. He's come from the A-League in Japan. You know, he's lit up Scottish football. So let's see how he does against better opposition. And I'd be certain there are, again, I get criticised, richer clubs, if not bigger clubs than Celtic, watching how Kyogo does in the Champions League environment.
They're also in with RB Leipzig and Shakhtar, who will play their home games in Poland. You know, they were in pot four, but given that Shakhtar have lost so many players, they, you know, third should be what they should achieve. But they could. Do you think they'll go in hoping they can pip Leipzig or for that second spot?
I think Celtic would take the not unreasonable attitude. If Rangers can see them off after two games, Celtic are capable of beating them. The warning sign for Celtic is Bodo Glimt hammered them last season, really, in the last set of European games that Celtic played. And this is a new environment for a lot of the players. The Champions League is going to be fresh. I worry about Celtic defensively against... Well, I don't worry. It doesn't cause me sleepless nights. But I would have question marks over Celtic's defence against better teams. So that's where I would maybe have an area of concern for them. But, you know, it's new. Third place, I think, would be an excellent return. But probably, again, having looked at what happened with Leipzig last season, it's not crazy or unreasonable for them to at least aim for second.
Rangers are in with Liverpool, Napoli and Ajax, which it's just a perfect Champions League group, that, isn't it?
Yes. I do laugh at this. Traditionalists, it's a fantastic... I mean, it's as if the Champions League's been in existence for 100 years. Yeah, they're, I think the point is they're all big clubs, yeah. And
yeah, I mean, it's big and there's, you know, there's sort of... It's a good variety. It like ticks lots of boxes in a sort of purest sense, but I take your point.
No, and the England-Scotland thing is always fascinating. And I think... My sense always when these games come around is even people who... Or some people who don't support or have much love for Rangers will end up getting irked by kind of what they'll see as dismissive tones from south of the border. The games against Liverpool. So there's always a slight grudging support for Rangers doing something against a big English team. So that'll be fascinating. Napoli, yeah, they'll be great games. And Rangers, you know, the bigger picture with Rangers, they waited a long time to get back into this Champions League platform after the 10, well, it wasn't 10 years of turmoil, but they had a few years of turmoil in the middle of getting back to winning the Championship, getting to Europa League final. And they'll see this not unreasonably as a further step in their kind of journey back to being a big and prominent on the pitch football club. So this carries broader significance for Rangers, I think. And you're right, they fully deserve to beat. I mean, it was a comedy goal in Eindhoven that they got them through. But after that, PSV did not trouble Rangers. A PSV team who had been really doing very well, they didn't trouble Rangers at all. And they fully deserve to be in this environment.
While we've got you, Hearts have started okay, haven't they?
That's a bit of a sore point this morning. Oh. Just been bundled out the League Cup, which they haven't won since 1962. Next.
Who bundled them?
Kilmarnock.
Oh. Oh, that's why Andy said, would Kilmarnock win the league if they move all their games to Tynecastle? but I mean, you've started the league pretty well, but you don't necessarily think you'll be able to keep up the pace, right?
Hearts have started the league fine, but they've got a batch of injuries and they're in this unknown territory of playing what is Conference League football, so it's, you know, a lot of Thursday, Sunday game schedule weeks, which they aren't used to, and it's going to take them a bit to adjust. If Hearts can get within touching distance of third place at the time the World Cup break comes around, they'll be doing pretty well.
A question on the LIV Golf Tour, which obviously you're covering as the golf correspondent as well. No. It's football related, which is just like, have you? Because it's quite interesting when we talk about when somebody mentions the golf. Who doesn't follow football goes, why aren't the footballers getting any shit? And when anyone who follows football who doesn't follow golf says, why are the golfers not getting any shit? Do you think they're getting similar amounts? How do you view it in terms of what, you know, Newcastle United have had to deal with questions-wise compared to the golfers?
That's a good question, Max. Very good question. And an interesting subject.
Thank you.
Interesting subject. I think, historically, golfers really get no criticism at all. Golfers have lived a charmed life, and I make this point to golfers because I know a lot of reasonably high profile football players who live their lives in the quite often the front, if not the back pages of newspapers, and the scrutiny and criticism they get normally is way different to what golfers ever receive. So what's happened now is golfers have had, I would argue, not unwarranted and not unreasonable levels of criticism for jumping over to live. And golfers have gone, well, hang on, what's going on here? Because they're not used to that. It hasn't happened to them before. I think that's what's happened. And I also think a key distinction is a football player at Newcastle United, to a major extent, cannot determine that he plays for Newcastle United. If a club wants to sell him or not sell him, you know, he's an employee of a football club. Whether he's sold to Newcastle or wants to leave Newcastle, that's not really up to him. Golfers are different. I mean, it's entirely in a golfer's own gift to decide, you know, where they want to play, when they want to play. So they have made this decision off their own backs. And also, you know, the key point, they're already largely multi-millionaires who have, you know, just jumped for even more money, which people find a bit tasteless. So I think there is crossover, but I think there's a key difference in terms of what footballers can reasonably do and what golfers have chosen to do.
I think as well, footballers aren't getting as much jip as golfers, because they take Mark Targett, for example. He signed for Newcastle. He wasn't signed for a preposterous amount of money, and he's getting the going rate wages-wise for a well-paid Premier League left-back. So it's not like he's being paid 10 times as much money to play in a league that has nothing to do with the Premier League, or to play in a league with other footballers who aren't as good as most Premier League footballers. So, although that's increasingly less the case now in Liv, because they're getting some big, big names.
I do think Eddie Howe is actually different, though. I mean, he as an out-of-work manager, who, funnily enough, crossover could well have gone to Celtic, but he had a choice as to where he was going to go and work. And you know, this was going to be the first managerial appointment of this new regime at Newcastle. He did have a fundamental choice to make, and I don't think he has ever explained that anywhere near adequately. So I think he's a bit different, but the players themselves, I think, you know, I would be uneasy with people laying into them. I think their situation's not quite the same as any live golfer.
Thanks for coming on, Ewan. Always nice to talk to you.
Chat to you soon, hopefully.
Have a lovely day. Ewan Murray there, our Scottish football correspondent. James says, are we all excited for transfer deadline day? How many players will Chelsea buy? Yeah, they've got Fofana. They're in perhaps for, well, Neymar, Edson Alvarez, Aubameyang, Rafael Leao. It's sort of insane. I should ask Johnny a question, since your audio is now in good quality. It's worth you saying something in this part for this podcast that we can hear. What do you make of Chelsea's... I mean, we will find out. They may not get none of these people. I think Aubameyang looks likely. That's what people are saying now.
Yeah, and apparently Guardiola at Leipzig is another one that they've been linked with. I was at the Southampton game on Tuesday night, and watching them try to break Southampton down in the second half, what struck me most of all was that the thing they do not need is another player to throw into that mix. That, I mean, they are incoherent enough. They look as though they don't know each other. They look as though they've never played with each other. They look as though they've been signed kind of almost at random by sticking a pin into a list, and that's the way they play, because that's almost how that squad has been assembled. What they need is time on the training pitch. What they need is, you know, some games together. And it, like, the last 6 months at Chelsea have been so turbulent for so many different reasons. They all kind of look a little bit shell-shocked by it. And yet, what Todd Bowley, his vision for Chelsea is to create this rolling entertainment product where, you know, almost along kind of Manchester United lines, where, you know, you sign the best and you sign the best every window. You know, if you have to pay over the odds for them, you will make it back in the end. And that appears to be the way that he's approached this transfer window, and it may well work out for them in the long time. That there is enough money and there is enough will behind that project that they will eventually kind of financially bully their way to being a decent side at some point. But they are nowhere near that at the moment. They're so flaky. Tuchel pointed this out. Like, you know, they said they needed to toughen up. He said, like, it's too easy to bully us, and that's the sort of thing that new players just don't, you know. They don't solve that problem. That's culture, and that's standards, and that's mentality.
Well, look, we will find out who buys who, and we'll talk about it on Monday if it's interesting. Stu says, Preston are the story, the only unbeaten team in the Championship, the only team in the four leagues not to concede a goal. Another, you know, they've had nil-nils apart from 2 1-0 wins this season. They won 1-0 at Coventry. It is extraordinary. He does say, I know you mentioned Preston for 30 seconds the other day, but it's pretty bonkers and unique. Or just rehash the usual Premier League chat. Well, if you've got this far, you'll notice that's exactly what we've done. We don't have a lot of time left. John says, Max, cheaters aren't part of the Big Five. They're basically like Spurs joining a Super League and claiming there's a Big Six. My apologies to what? Lions, Tigers, Rhinos, Elephants, and what's the other one? The Leopard? Is the Leopard in the Big Five? Someone will tell us. At someone noticed, it was the hustings, you know, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak doing their last kind of can I please be Prime Minister? And I sent a tweet going, I was wondering who could possibly want to go, you know, like even if you really loved them, do you have so much time to go to sit in an auditorium and hold a, you know, Liz for leader?
Wembley Arena. It was in Wembley Arena.
Wembley, was it? Was it really? Wow, that's tremendous. God, we couldn't fill Wembley Arena, could we, Barry? Oh, we could do the O2, but we couldn't do Wembley Arena.
Oh, I don't think it was remotely full.
Anyway, but somebody tweeted me, Paul, and I imagine it's a lie, but it was very funny to say. I saw one saying, Rishi, can I have your shirt after the speeches, please? Which is bringing some football fandom into political hustings. So thanks for that, Paul. And that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Jordan.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you, Barry.
Thanks, Mac.
Thanks, Johnny.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.